it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
I want to welcome everyone to episode number 29 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective of the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE. Madison Square Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back at all these shows, a man who went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting on August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how you doing?
And I love to talk about it today.
Yes. Yes, you did. Did you ever think back then you'd be talking about this 50 years later and people be listening?
No.
They'd be listening?
No, never did. Never.
And now we got someone who is just like you. We found someone who is just like
yeah.
you. Who went to these shows 50 years ago and can talk with you about this because I can talk and I can ask questions, but this guy was with you. He was with you at these shows.
Yeah, I met him actually. I met him at the first time. I think it was at the concession stand.
You were both
waiting
in line.
We went on hot dogs
yeah.
that were burnt.
Yeah.
The little thing. And it was, and we started talking wrestling. And here we are 50 years later. He's a legend. Kerry Silkin, one of the founders, Ring of Honor, a wrestling historian. Everybody loves him in the wrestling business. Never heard anything but wonderful accolades about him. Beloved by Ric Flair. Let's bring him on. Kerry, how you doing?
I'm doing well. thanks for having me back, guys. There are some people that don't like me, but that's all right.
Hey, same here.
You don't want everybody to like you.
Not everyone's loved. Not everyone's loved.
But anyway, you're going to be joining us on, you know, as your schedule permits. As all of us, you know, we're quite busy doing all the things that we do. But this is kind of your sweet spot. You were going to the Garden every single month at that time. So then we got really legitimately great response from the people who listen to the show about how beneficial you are. They love the exchange of stories. So we're going to bring you on every episode as long as you want to come on.
And before we start, we talk about John 1971. Kerry, when was your first show at the Garden?
We had spoken about this briefly. My exact 14th birthday, the Pedro Morales, Fred Blassie, November 15th, 1971. So I was there at Blassie Morales number one. I was one of the, let's face it. The crowd was 95% Puerto Rican. Is it in bad taste to say that? I don't think so. You could say, oh, it was Latino. They were Puerto Rican people in New York City, not Mexican people. It's just what was the population. And they were there to support Pedro Morales. John, am I safe to say the crowd was 80 to 90% Latino?
They were Puerto Rican.
All right. Do I have the percentiles correct?
Yes.
Right. And when Blassie came out, I was sitting in some lousy seats that my Uncle Henry went and got us. We were in the old Reds, the Loge. Picture the hockey arena, the far end, which really is not a good view. But I was at the Garden. I was there. When Blassie came out, I stood up. My father grabbed me by my jeans and he's going to sit down. You're going to get us killed here. And he was right. So, and it really wasn't a good match. You know, it's funny. these shows I haven't been on with you guys. I'm a faithful listener. It's like some of these matches were so shitty, most of them, but it didn't matter. That Blassie-Morales match, even in my 14-year-old head, was I a smart fan at that point? A little, but they just didn't give you enough.
What's the matter? You didn't like Chuck Richards against the Black Demon that night? You didn't like that one? That wasn't a 5-star one for you? It didn't motivate you to be a promoter years later?
Maybe that was it. But a lot of these matches, even the main events, they just teased you.
One of the things we always talk about on the show, Kerry, is the atmosphere and how things have changed over the years. Now it's like, you know, it's not as much, it kind of is character driven, but it's not story driven as much. Where before, you'd be on TV every week and you're saying this and that, and being at the Garden and seeing them live for the first time, it'd be like an energy you get. It wouldn't be a false energy, it'd be a real energy. So did you find that at the Garden? And even though these matches weren't the greatest matches in the world, the energy for the stars that they had, either they would bring them in or somebody who's been there a long time.
Absolutely. And we spoke about this last time I was on. It was like a tradition. There was a protocol almost. At about 8:20, as the place was filling up, there was a rumbling and this whistling.
Whistling.
It was whistling.
And the stomping of the feet.
Right, whistling and the rumbling. So by about 8:27, 8:28, so it's unfortunate. And maybe somewhere there's actual video where you could hear this. But, John, am I lying? I
mean, no, that's exactly right. And it was a crescendo. And then that bell rang and the lights went out.
The ring lights
went on, and that was it.
That's
the
all
crowd
you need.
Popped.
You didn't need the entrance music. You didn't need the fireworks. You didn't need any rock and roll kind of lighting. You just needed those hot white lights, and they came down strong. And the other thing I used to like, and I think it still existed at this point of today's show, was the ring mic. Coming down from the center.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
And Johnny Addy was the ring announcer, I believe, for that first night. That little guy who was great. Yeah, in this corner, weighing in at 242 pounds from Santa Monica, California, the Pacific Coast champion, Freddie Blassie. And cigarette smoke.
Oh, smoking
everywhere. Cigars, I mean, cigarettes.
Cigars, cigarettes. And you know, going up to the show we're doing today was when I was going to some of my early rock and roll shows. But this was a different kind of smoke-filled arena. And by the way, with that Blassie match, as the early ones that you guys and I've had been on a few of them, they were using the old boxing ring, Tim.
Yes.
4-roped ring, no give in the middle.
Nope. Red. Which velvet.
I sort of didn't know at the time a little, but it was a big ring.
Big ring.
There's none of these Madison Square Garden shows like the entirety on Peacock or on YouTube. There's some shots of it and some matches, but I'd love to see an entire show, but it is what it is.
When did that change? When did they go from a boxing ring at the Garden to a wrestling ring?
72.
Yeah.
72.
No wonder why they weren't doing any special moves in there, because it would hurt.
Right. It was hard as a rock. John, I was watching something, and I sent it to John with the popular Mrs. Krieger.
Georgette Krieger and her sister.
Last time I was on, we had a long discussion about John's good friend. I'm gonna mess up her name. Georgiana Macropoulos.
Georgiane Macropoulos. She was known as Georgiane Orsi.
Georgiane Orsi, the head of the Bruno fan club. You've heard the stories from John. I don't, you know, if I would have known John, I would have somehow slithered into that little club in the
that little group.
Yes, in the old bowling alley at the Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't. But Mrs. Krieger, they saved her a front row seat. It's 1973. I forget what the main event was, but Mrs. Krieger starts messing around with Professor Tanaka in the ring, wiping the salt.
Yes.
And they let her do it.
Yes.
You know, and she would shake her butt, you know, and she would turn around. One time after the matches, my cousin and I would park at Port Authority parking lot. When John was rushing for the train at 10:50 or 10:55, we're moseying up 8th Avenue in the 70s. It was interesting. Rough.
It was rough.
There's Mrs. Krieger and her sister.
Yeah.
It's too little late. So we sort of walked. They were catching that last bus. You know where they were from. Baltimore.
Baltimore. Yeah.
Yes.
This is why you're on, Carrie. This is why you're on. Because finding out about Mrs. Krieger and all that's going on, and I'm so happy you're going to be joining us just for those little tidbits. Just for those little tidbits. Before we start the show, I want to get back into real quick. John, you've been busy. Last time we talked, you know, the baseball season was starting, spring training was starting, and you had some podcasts that hadn't been announced yet. So really quick, can we go over just what you've been up to besides your, you know, with your wrestling podcast and your baseball podcast, all the stuff that you've been up to?
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. You forgot to mention the COVID season.
Oh, yeah. Should we hit that now?
I got COVID right now. Got it in Florida.
It's not gone, people. It's still around, and John's got it.
Yeah, I can attest to that. And I've had 5 boosters, so what do you say? So anyway, yeah, these baseball shows are now fully available to be announced because we're in production. I did a deal, and I'm pinching myself. As everybody knows, last season, 2023, I did a show with John Gibbons, who was the manager of Toronto Blue Jays. We had a very successful season, and then John got hired by the New York Mets to be their bench coach, and that was November 20th. So I had a pivot. What am I going to do now? Since Gibby's with the Mets, I can't do a show with them anymore. And my passion was always the Mets. You know, that's my team since I was a little kid. So through my buddy Donnie Liable, who I'm sure you guys know the name. I had put together a short list. I was like, I would love to do a Mets podcast, but I need somebody high profile to do it with, and I need phone numbers. So I said, Donnie, can you get me these guys' phone numbers? One of those guys on that short list of 5 was Terry Collins, who was the Mets manager, managed more games for the franchise than anyone in their history, came in 2011 and lasted until the end of the 2017 season. Was the last manager to bring the Mets to the World Series in 2015. Beloved manager, like Gibby is in Canada, Terry's in New York. The only manager that had more wins than Terry was Davey Johnson. So I called Terry, left a message. He calls me back in like 10 minutes. We have a great conversation, and he agrees to do a podcast with me. He's an analyst on SNY, the Mets TV network. He's on there. He's actually heading to New York right now for opening week. He's going to be on the pre and post game show, and he's an analyst for Baseball Tonight in New York. And he agreed to do it. And we have a podcast that actually the first episode is out. Our first guest is the Mets captain, David Wright, number 5. And we also had on Andy Martino, who is another big beat writer and a reporter. It's got a book about the New York Yankees coming out, the inside story of the Brian Cashman era. So Andy's a writer, but he's also on SNY. So yeah, that show is out, and I'm so excited to do that show. And the other show we kicked off, it's called The Brushback with J.P. Ricciardi. J.P. Ricciardi was my other roommate with John Gibbons back in 1981. We shared a house in Shelby, North Carolina, in Class A minor league ball. JP went on to not make it as a player, but after his playing career was over, he worked in the Yankees organization, worked for the Milwaukee Brewers for a bit, was one of the guys who was one of those originators who worked with the team with Billy Beane and Sandy Alderson and Joe DePodesta. He was one of the original Moneyball crew in Oakland. He's the one that hired Paul DePodesta, who was played by Jonah Hill in the movie Moneyball. So JP then went and got hired by the Toronto Blue Jays to be their general manager. And JP was the guy who hired Gibby to manage the Toronto Blue Jays and fired Gibby. And then Gibby got rehired. So, and then JP went on to work for the New York Mets. Sandy Alderson from Money, you know, the Moneyball guy, went to the New York Mets to be their GM. He brought JP in to be his special assistant. So JP spent 8 years in the Mets organization. And then JP in 2018 went over to San Francisco Giants to be the special assistant to the head of baseball operations. And JP decided that after 43 years as a GM, as one of the top executives in the game, that he had had enough and, you know, spoke to him. And before you know it, you know, we have a podcast. The Brushback with JP. And that's going to be a podcast about the inside workings of baseball. It's going to be a podcast that's going to talk about, you know, JP has all of this history, but he's going to bring on top executives, baseball players, scouts, development people from the, you know, who develops the players. So his insight into the game is so spectacular. So between the Terry Collins show and the Brushback with JP Ricciardi, there are two baseball shows that I'm doing now, and each one are weekly. So I'm very excited about those opportunities. Like I said, I'm pinching myself. I never thought that I'd be doing this. And we just brought on a senior vice president who I worked with at Scripps Networks, and he's now heading up our sales department for what I'm now calling the Baseball Podcast Network.
Nice.
Wow. That's awesome. Can't wait to start listening to some of these. So real quick, give us the name of both podcasts and where we can find them.
Yeah, they're available everywhere. The Terry Collins Show, The Brushback with JP Ricciardi, available anywhere you hear your favorite podcasts, and both of them have channels on YouTube.
All right. How about your wrestling podcast? How about your other wrestling podcast? I know you're reforming that. Are you going to still be doing that?
Yes. Yeah, we just did a special look back at March, the Best of Pro Wrestling Spotlight in March. We're not doing a weekly show anymore because we run through the original episodes. So now we're going to be reviewing month by month. We're going to kick off the new Pro Wrestling Spotlight Rewind, is what we're calling it, with a look back at the shows that I did in college in the 70s. So we have tapes. I'm bringing on the guy that was my engineer at the college station, and he's one of my best friends to this day, and also another guy named Vinny Kice. So it's Vinny Kice and Larry Simmons, and Vinny used to come do the show with me, and he's a big country music programmer in Virginia. And so we're going to have our first reunion. We'll actually see each other together for the first time in 50 years on this podcast, and we're going to just laugh at some of the old college pro wrestling spotlight episodes that we did back then. And then we're going to go the best of April of 89, because now it's 35 years that show launched. The best of May, 89. And then we're going to continue the run till who knows when, you know. And now we do this. And now Carrie's with us. What the hell? Life is good.
It's been a good year so far. Definitely a good year. And I was thinking about this one. I got in touch with somebody, one of your old producers on Facebook. Was it Dr. Whitefinger? Is that what you called him?
Yes.
I found Dr. Whitefinger.
No kidding.
Yeah, we will talk
GBB.
To him. Yeah, GBB, when he shows on GBB, and he's the one who had to call some of these wrestlers. He had to screen your phone calls. He had to run your board for you. So we will get him on in future episodes.
Wait, hold on. What was Dr. Whitefinger, his nickname? Was he a proctologist or something?
No, he had cut his finger one. He showed up at the studio on his hand. His old bandage up, and I was like, what's going on, Dr. Whitefinger? You know, it's like, so anyway, that just nickname stuck.
What made it so funny, Kerry, is because back in the day, he's running everything. So back in the day, you had carts, you had all these things, you had to move around, and he had like one wrapped up hand and an empty hand. So that one hand had to do everything. That one hand, and the other one looked like a thumb with white fingers next to it. And he that thing was on for a while. He was doing everything one-handed, which is amazing at the time.
Yeah, I mean, crazy. It was crazy back then. It was good. And Tim, let me ask you a question. Now we're speaking about radio before we get into this today. Did you ever work at B103 on Long Island?
No.
WBZO, the oldie station?
No, I just did WBAB, and I was at Z100 in New York, and then later on, I worked for, Kerry, here you go, name drop, I worked for a guy named Danny Bonaducci at Big 105 in New York City.
Mm-hmm. I met him one time.
Yeah, he was a partier for sure.
Yes.
He was.
Yeah. But the reason I bring up BZO, and it kind of ties into this podcast a little bit, right?
Okay.
WBZO, which was a legacy oldie station, just changed format. They turned country this past week, and they changed their call letters. It's not WBZO anymore, and I found this quite fascinating. Their new calls are WWWF.
Huh.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
I'm surprised it's legal.
I know. That's what I was saying. I was like, isn't this protected or something? Didn't they copyright this or trademark these four letters? I don't know if it's applicable to radio.
No, I don't think it is. And I think the WWE doesn't own it because they lost a lawsuit with the World Wildlife Fund. So they don't own it anymore. The World Wildlife Fund was fine with the WWF until it started going worldwide.
Yes, but this was the other. This was the additional W. So this is even this predates obviously WWF losing that lawsuit. But I just found that I was like WWF. You know, Long Island's country.
Okay, I thought you wanted to pitch our show to them because we are talking about the WWF.
Felt that I was like, what? I just found that fascinating this week. It's a little tidbit. You know, when you got COVID, you're sitting around, you're not doing much of anything. I'm not outside. So I saw the change of the call letters, and I worked for the same company as WBZO B103. And I'm like, now they're WWWF?
I just got to throw something in here. My Last Stop Penn Station podcast essentially chronicles my life, my wrestling fandom, my being involved in the ticket business on the street as a scalper, doing cocaine and making a little business arrangement with John Belushi and some of the guys in Rush and Thin Lizzy and the road crews. You know, I used to know everybody wants to meet their favorite bands, right? If you're not a female, you had to have something. And I learned that, you know, cocaine was a male groupie's entrance.
Yes.
So all these stories are available on my podcast, Last Stop Penn Station.
Yeah.
There's 70 episodes, which I did with Ian Riccoboni, who's still the Ring of Honor commentator. But my point, my circuitous route was, and you guys will attest to this, nicknames have gone the way of the dinosaur. Mm. Like back when I was hustling tickets on the street, all these guys had nicknames. Silent Sydney, Blockhead, the Black Cow, Drugstore, the Sabu Brothers, Sha-na-na, so on and so forth. And you don't hear, and John brought up, what was he, White Fingered?
Dr. White Finger.
Right. Now, nicknames, it's a dying art. Yeah. Do you guys agree with me? Like, you don't
Absolutely.
Hear.
Yes and no. It's dead when people give you a nickname. Now all these stars make up their own nicknames. All the rappers make up their own nicknames and give it to themselves. Where back in the day, someone would call you something. My last name is Poutre. Putt-putt. Always putter. Putter. You know, and that would last. And you, like, someone would come, if I was working somewhere, someone would ask for, hey, is Tim here? And people were looking around, oh, Putter, he's over there. Like, your nickname back in the day was your calling card. No one really would know your real name. Sometimes something would happen to you, and then when you look around, people would ask, how do we get in touch with their family? What's your last name? Because they didn't know. No one knew.
Right. I had one in college, which some of my closest, dearest college friends still call me. I lived with it for, you know, throughout my college.
Come on.
Let's have it.
It was JIT.
That's nothing.
What?
JIT.
For why? Why JIT?
Well, there was a guy that we called Paul the Pervert Rose. That was his name.
That's
he was from
a great
Camden.
Name.
He was from Camden, New Jersey. And he would be like this tough guy. He was a big Springsteen fan. And we used to hang out with him in school. And we were talking, joking around something. And he goes, you're just a JIT stain. I was like, what's JIT? What is that? JIT, you know, not, and he started making the signs like he was whacking off.
Right. I was going to say this is not J-I-Z, it's J-I-T.
J-I-T. So it was like, I just went nuts and it was like, JIT, oh my God, you know, and they started calling me JIT. And so all my friends were like, hey, JIT, and they still, that's how I get a text, JIT, what's going on, JIT, man?
Nothing wrong you know? With that.
But it was like, that was a nickname back then. It was like, even the girls, hey, JIT, how you doing? All good, you know, come, you know, whatever, you know. So that was back in the day in the 70s, man.
They had no idea. They had no idea it was a bad name. They had no idea it was a bad name.
No, well, the girls didn't know.
Wasn't.
And then when I told them, they're like, oh, my God.
Let's move on because this is how the show's going to go. If you're looking for a shorter episode, don't listen to our show. Because he's
loving it.
We're not about shortness. We like to do carry on the show. Moving a little forward, before we get into the show of the day, we like to look back at the WWF offices at that period with something we call From the Office. So from the WWF office today, we want to look back on Phil Zacco. Phil Zacco. John, you want to tell us about Phil Zacco?
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Echo.
He was a short little guy with a crooked neck. Like he would... I'm serious. He'd look at you. It was almost like he was like a curious dog or cat. Like that's how he would look. And it was a little mean guy. He threw me out of the back in Philadelphia because I was spotted at an IWA show, The Opposition. So he goes, "You were seen at The Opposition. So you get, you know," and he threw me out because I went to an opposition show, IWA. To me, he just was a son of a bitch. I mean, he not a nice guy. If you ever watched that Ali jump in the ring against Gorilla Monsoon, he's the one that actually came out and got Ali to get out of the ring. And he's running around with that crooked neck and he just got him. But anyway, he's a legend. He was one of the guys that had a little ownership, a little piece.
Now, last month, you were talking about Willie Gilsenberg.
Yes.
Yes, little Willie, another little short guy.
Okay.
Can Shuffling I Willie.
I should have been on the last episode. You know, my parents were Newark, New Jersey, Russian Jewish heritage. My father would say, "Boy, we're half-assed Jews." Like they didn't get bar mitzvahed. They had me bar mitzvahed just because it was the right thing. But anyway, they all knew Willie Gilsenberg. He was from Newark and he had a partner. His partner's name was Babe Cullen. Oh. Now, Willie Gilsenberg, Kevin Sullivan told me this. I didn't know this. He was banned for fixing boxing matches. No and the point. New York, yes, and the New York State Athletic Commission, it took him a while to get back to the garden. And like John said so perfectly, Willie would just shuffle. He didn't walk. I mean, these days with my back, I don't walk that well, but Willie would just shuffle along. My classic Willie Gilsenberg story of personal, I feel like I've told you this to you guys before, but it's worth hearing. We went to the Ritz Theater in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not the Elizabeth Armory. Right. Maybe the Elizabeth Armory was going through a tough time. Now, the Ritz Theater in Elizabeth, it was a theater. You had a stage. It's not the right place for wrestling. I remember that Haystacks Calhoun was in one of the main, the main attraction. We go up to the box office, and on a white piece of paper with, I don't even think it was magic marker. It was like heavy pen. It said, "Calhoun not here, leg infection, no refunds." I remember getting like fourth or fifth row ringside or whatever they were. Willie Gilsenberg was the local promoter and the money guy. So instead of just leaving bad enough alone with that sign, he took it upon himself to drag himself into the ring before the opening match. And he tripped on the bottom rope at the Ritz Theater. There were two items you could buy to drink. Beer, they knew to sell it in cups, or not soda. I don't know why. Remember in school, those orange juice cartons?
Yeah.
So Gilsenberg climbs up. And he trips and he gets up and he's like, he's all flustered. "Calhoun's not here." And the fans started pelting him with the cups and the orange juice things. And this is not a G-rated show, right?
No, it's not.
Gilsenberg goes, "Stop it. Stop it, God damn it. I'll close this fucking thing down. Calhoun's not here. I'm not giving y'all back a nickel."
Oh, Willie.
That's my Willie story.
And I remember
it was worth getting.
I remember him shuffling. He used to shuffle from that dressing room to the ring to hand the ring out to the card for next month. He just would be waiting. There he goes. He's got the fucking lineup. And hurry up.
which leads to another name. We'll never get to this show. Elliot. What was his
Besser.
Name?
Professor Elliot Maron.
Right. And he eventually was the guy that would give the card in later years, if I'm not later mistaken. Years.
He used to take the ring jackets back and the belts back to the dressing room.
Professor Elliot. How the hell did he ever get
He's the one that told me that he's the one where I finally learned that wrestling was a work. The night at Shea Stadium when Bruno and Morales were fighting. He comes out of Shea and he's like, you know, Elliot was like, it's going to be a draw tonight. I was like, what? What do you mean? It's going to be a draw. On a curfew.
All right, we'll have to have Richie put this guy's name in the hat for the office. Poor Phil Zacco. We just went right by Phil Zacco.
I'm sorry.
Dead. That's okay. We're That's dead. How the show goes. He's one sixth owner of the WWE, the WWF at the time. He's a World War II veteran, promoted from Baltimore, Washington, and Philly. From 1969 to 1982, he was Vince Sr.'s right-hand man. And John, there was a very famous story about him. Want to tell me and Carrie about it?
There's so many. This one was he's trying to shortchange Wahoo on a payoff, and Phil hid as Haystack Calhoun and Bobo Brazil tried to hold McDaniel back from him. He stiffed him on a payoff.
That'd be the wrong guy to stiff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then he was exaggerating the attendance of the 1980 Shea Stadium show in an interview. He claimed... Bruno versus Zbyszko, he claimed the attendance was 87,250. So he was a little off. The crowd was 36, but, you know, he was only 51,000 people off. You know, good promoter knows how to embellish a little bit.
Let me say this. Now, we go to the Garden every month. Now, we couldn't go to the Garden last month. We went to Shea Stadium. Now, we drew 87,250 people. Over $500,000 in money.
Well, that's something. The reality is with the State Athletic Commission, from my experience with Ring of Honor in New York and Pennsylvania, and you guys know this, the Athletic Commission is there for one reason only. They had their hand out.
Want that so tax money.
I want to tell them there was less people.
Yeah.
If anything.
Not more.
Right. Not more. But it is what it is. Yeah, Phil Zacco, his name was bandied about forever. Baltimore, Philadelphia, I'm sure he was in the boxing game too. They all were.
Well, finally, we've been going for almost 40 minutes, a little over 40 minutes right now. Let's talk about today's show. Can we talk about today's show?
What do you mean? What show?
There's a card. There's a card we're here for.
Oh, that's right.
The reason we all got here. is we're talking about tonight's show, April 1st, 1974. But the buildup, Kerry, John, last time at the Garden, Nikolai Volkoff went 53 minutes with Bruno. Was this a big buildup for this time at the Garden?
Yes, absolutely. And I can't believe, and you guys discussed this, it was only because of the love that everyone had for Bruno that they would put up with 53 minutes. John, was it like 53 minutes of fabulous action?
Oh, no.
Right.
Arm drags, arm bars.
But it was Bruno.
It was Bruno, so it didn't matter.
You had the respect.
It didn't matter. It was Bruno.
And let's go back to that for a second. What they're missing today, what they had back then, when you're saying Bruno versus Nikolai Volkoff, you're thinking about just like kicks, a lot of kicks. Everyone like they both like to kick a lot, or headlocks, or feats of strength that normally are just very. But everyone loved Bruno so much, no matter what he did, he was great. I always compare Bruno to like Dusty Rhodes. You never saw Dusty Rhodes jumping off the top rope or anything, but he had the crowd in his hands, and that's what Bruno had at the Garden. He had people in his hands the whole time, so he could have been wrestling a chair for God's sake, and people would still cheer for him.
Without doubt.
Absolutely. The decision to do that 53 minutes, and that was the curfew, causing John probably to miss his train.
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Because you wouldn't want to leave.
11:10 train, I couldn't leave. It was Bruno.
But at that point, Volkoff was still athletic enough that he appeared to be a threat.
That is right. And Blassie, of course, Blassie not at ringside, but Blassie, the manager, you know, had that little special extra reason to hate Volkoff.
So let's see how he does tonight. Speaking of tonight's show, Kerry, we know where John gets his tickets. Where did you get your tickets? Do you remember, Kerry?
I used to go with my cousin Mike, and he was 4 years older than me. He had his license, and he would drive into the city. You know, it's funny with me winding up with a whole career in the ticket industry and knowing every move there is to get pay off this guy, and later years, the bots with the Ticketmaster and blah, blah, blah. We were happy sitting in the second level, the orange, and we'd met these guys from Coney Island, Randy and Howie, who I know are both still with us. Both of them in later years came to Ring of Honor. 1973, 4, 5, we would go, my cousin, myself, Randy, and Howie. There might have been another one or two. We were happy sitting dead center in the orange section, which was about 18, 20 rows up. Very good view. My cousin would drive in to get the tickets the morning after the show the following day. Right to the Garden.
Right to the Garden.
Ticket miss, no telecharge, no Ticketron, nothing.
The old box office, something that people don't even know what it is. What is a box office today? I don't think anybody buys their tickets from a box office anymore. It's just, it's a lost tradition that we used to love so much. Also, Kerry, I'm sure you heard this on the show before. John used to wait outside of the mall before it opened up so he can go inside to go into, was it A&S or Macy's? Where'd you buy your, you had to go through?
A&S, Ticketron, A&S in West Babylon, second floor.
I remember like when you would drive by and they'd be having, you know, the tickets are going on sale that morning or maybe the next morning for some concert, and there'd be a line outside the mall because everyone's in line to go get those tickets. Well, let's go to today's card, the WWWF New York City Madison Square Garden, Monday night, April 1st, 1974. Bell time is at 8:30, and it's a sellout crowd of 22,090. Scheduled was Butcher Brannigan versus Mario Soto, and the match never did take place. Let's go to the first match. Jumbo Tsuruta pinned Johnny Rods, and this match wasn't even on the card.
Tsuruta, it was billed as Tommy Tsuruta on this show. I guess maybe they were trying to Americanize him. It was his first and only appearance at Madison Square Garden. He died really young, age of 49 in 2000, had complications from a liver transplant. He made his debut 1973, retired in 1999. He was trained by Dory Funk Jr. and Luthez. Baba sent Tsuruta to Amarillo to be trained by the Funks because he had high hopes for him, and he became one of the biggest stars in Japan. He was among the first Japanese wrestlers to be cheered by an American crowd. He had really, you know, good, you know, movie star looks, trim, and he was a kind of a consummate, good-looking Japanese performer wrestler. On February 23rd, in 84, he defeated Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA Heavyweight Championship in Tokyo. He would lose the title weeks later to Rick Martel. He had a 26-year career. He had over 3,000 matches, 3,329. He was voted into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame in 1996.
Do you think, John, from your notes that you might have from Richie, that he was working for the Funks at the time and they sent him to New York?
That's a good possibility, for sure. It's not in the notes, but I'm sure that could have been the case.
I don't think he was a known that much. He became a very known name, but this is like a Tsuruta rookie match.
It was, absolutely. Yeah, he wasn't no big superstar at the time.
All right, let's go on to match number two. Otto Van Heller fought Jose, we call him the Killer, Gonzalez, to a 20-minute draw.
What can you say? I mean, Otto Van Heller, his real name is Mike Hall. He seemed to stick around in the early 70s for quite a while. Yeah. You knew he wasn't a major threat, but he wasn't a pushover. Like Otto Van Heller, Tim might have a title match against Pedro at Sunnyside Gardens.
Yes, he was one of those guys. The Sunnyside Garden, Brooklyn Rollerama, house show, high school. You know, he was one of those guys. He wasn't a Madison Square Garden main eventer, but he did have enough TV wins to warrant that type of placement on a card in some of the secondary and tertiary arenas.
Okay, here's a question for you. We know what jobbers are, people that put over stars. But then there's this upper echelon of jobbers, like SD Jones would be one of them in my book, where like you watch it because you never know, he could win. You never, and SD Jones, you know, he maybe won in some tag teams or something. So was Otto like that? Was Otto the one that they put, not at the Garden, like you said, the side match, but like when you're watching Otto on TV, if he was against another jobber, he'd be winning.
He'd win. Always. Yes. Yeah. It's another jobber. Yeah. Well, he wasn't even a job. I wouldn't even put him in that category as a jobber. He wasn't really. He was just lower mid-level guy. Instead of getting $25, he'd probably get $40.
There you go. That's a good night. Match number three, Larry Zbysko defeated Ed Sullivan at seven.
It's got to be Kevin Sullivan.
It's got to be. At 7 minutes, 29 seconds.
No, I think it was Ed Sullivan. Richie had researched that too. And I think I remember, I have pictures of that match. I was there ringside shooting. And I remember.
Okay.
And we have information about him too.
Yeah. Well, we have information about, of course, Zbysko. That was his first match for him at Madison Square Garden. And Zbysko's real name, Larry Whistler, collegiate wrestler, Penn State University, trained by Bruno and Guido Mongo. He made his debut in 71, retired in 2015. Larry went on to marry Kathleen Gagne, making Vern Gagne his stepfather and Greg Gagne his stepbrother, and took the name Zbysko as a tribute to the 1920s Polish wrestler Stanislaus Zbysko, one of the legendary early pro wrestlers. His biggest feud, obviously, with his mentor Bruno Sammartino. And then the slow turn where he challenged Bruno to a match, and it took a long time to build it. Each week he'd be saying, Bruno, please wrestle me, please wrestle me. And finally, Bruno agreed.
They built it up for 6 years.
Yeah, the student and the teacher, man.
6 years?
That's the way you really, you know, I remember Dutch Mantel telling me when I did my wrestling magazine, the big four issues in Puerto Rico back in 99, 2000, he was booking. And Dutch would say, Carrie, I do things here on the slow, like a softball pitcher, on the slow arc. We know WWF was very slow with their angles, if they even had any. They let this thing simmer for 6 years. And I just want to say one other thing. Even though I was turning towards enjoying the heels better than the baby faces, except Bruno, I liked Larry Zbysko because of his association to Bruno. Did you feel that way, John?
Felt the same way. He was Bruno's guy. So right. You'd always cheer from him. He was the guy. Bruno was the mentor. And then finally, that one match where Bruno and Larry were going at it on TV and scientific moves. And Larry kept getting frustrated because Bruno was showing him, you know, I am the teacher. You are the student. I know how to beat you. And it ended where Larry was outside the ring on that Philadelphia taping. If you watch that, what heat in the crowd. Bruno accidentally got Larry out of the ring. Bruno held the ropes for Larry to come back in the ring, but Larry attacked Bruno, and then he went out and got that wooden chair, and he hit Bruno so hard on the head, three chair shots. Bruno bladed. The blood was unbelievable. The crowd was going crazy. That started a feud. Larry threw that chair down, left Bruno a bloody mess in the ring, and that started that long feud. That made Larry Zbysko for the rest of his career. Great storytelling. Absolutely. They don't do it anymore, but that was amazing. And he was voted into the Hall of Fame in WWE in 2015.
And all those years on WWF TV, Championship Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling, you did not see any blood. And they didn't put up the X with this angle 6 years later, Bruno bleeding. They wanted you to really feel it, and it worked.
And it did. It totally worked. You know, Larry and I had an interesting relationship too. I mean, I had booked Larry in 1990. I had done my first wrestling fan convention, and then I did a smaller little event out in Hauppauge at a sports memorabilia store, and I booked Larry as the AWA champion to be there with Nancy Sullivan, with Woman, and with Cactus Jack. That was the auction where we auctioned off Cactus Jack's toilet bowl at that event. But anyway, what I remember most about it was that night, because we're in, you know, the hotel, and I put those guys up in Melville, Larry and Nancy. And Larry's like, come on, you know, let's get at, you know, let's go out, let's do something. So I wound up with Larry and Nancy, and I took them to in my hometown of West Babylon, New York, a restaurant called the Silver Pheasant, where I used to go as a kid, a nice Italian restaurant. But Larry was like, you know, I really want to find some pot. You know where I can get some pot? Nancy, too, is like, you know, yeah, Johnny, you know how to get anything. And I'm like, I'm racking my brain out. I didn't have anything. So I wound up calling one of my sponsors. I'm not going to mention his name. And I called him up and I was like, look, do you got any pot? Yeah, I got some. I'm going to come. I'll be right there. So I knock on my friend who's an advertiser on the show, on his door. He opens the door up and it's me standing with Larry Zbyszko and woman. We made Larry happy that night. But I had Larry on the radio show. And then I put together a reunion with Bruno for the first time, Bruno and Larry together for the very first time in 92. So I have fond memories of Larry. But Larry, he was always a little bit cocky. You know, he was Larry. You know, he was Larry. But those were great memories. It really was. But we also have some information about Ed Sullivan, Carrie. I think you'll find
it. Oh, please. School me.
Well, his real name was Reuben Huizor, and he debuted in 1964. So he wrestled for a while. He retired in 85. He was half of a tag team called the Mighty Yankees, and he teamed with Frank Morrell and was trained by Mike DiBiase, $10 Million Man DiBiase's stepfather. And he helped train Bob Holly, Hardcore Holly. So Ed Sullivan was actually booked on the March 4th show at the Garden against Don Leo Jonathan, but that was canceled. But that show was his first appearance at Madison Square Garden against Larry.
And if I might go back in time again, even to the 90s, if you knew Kerry, I bet you Kerry knew where you can get some weed back in the 90s. I'm just saying, Kerry. I'm not meaning to throw you under the bus.
Yeah.
Not meaning to throw you under the bus of any kind, but you probably knew somebody.
Okay. That's all right. All my stuff is on the Last Stop Penn Station podcast.
Yes.
Including what was the hotel on 8th Avenue? It was the Hilton, not the
Holland. Was it
the Holland? Not the Holland. 49th and 8th. In the 80s, the wrestlers stayed there.
It was the Holiday Inn?
It was the Holiday Inn. And one of my ticket scalping friends, he wasn't even a friend, Buggo, another nickname, Buggo Mike. He's like, hey, Tony Atlas is looking for some stuff. You know, he wanted some Coke. Can you get it? And I'm like, yeah. Make a long story short, I had to get the smokable variety, which is very in fashion. We met Tony Atlas, and you would think Tony Atlas would have said, come on, come up to my room, guys. He paid. He wanted to go into the men's room in the stall in the lobby of the Holiday Inn. And I'm in there with Tony Atlas and Buggo. This is when Tony Atlas was sort of on the down.
Yeah.
His back was to the door. I was trapped.
Yeah, he was big too.
And this is just a regular stall you were in? You weren't in the handicap stall? Because fitting all three of you guys in a stall.
No. And then
people are coming in and out. And, you know, I partook in a smokable hit. And that stuff is like, your brain's ready to explode. And I'm like, this guy's scaring the shit out of me.
Yeah. And then didn't he ask you and Buggo to go out and find him a girl with high heels so they could walk on his face or something?
That part didn't happen. Oh, those crazy wrestlers.
Oh, those crazy wrestlers.
And yet there's more to come. We still have a few more matches to talk about. All right, how about match number 4? The WWWF Tag Team Champions, Dean Ho and Tony Garea, defeated Professor Toru Tanaka and Mr. Fuji by disqualification.
Solid. Solid tag.
So to my memory, it's 50 fucking years ago, this was a quality match. It was not like we've seen earlier in the card with Otto Von Heller and Jose Gonzalez and Zbyszko. We put up with because we liked Zbyszko. But this was a match where there's some competition and some action and something where even guys like John and I, myself, who were smart enough at this time, were engaged in the match.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And they always worked well together. You know, the championship was on the line. The fans loved Garea. They loved Ho. They hated Tanaka. They hated Fuji. This was a two out of three fall match. But Garea and Ho won in two falls. First fall was a pinfall, and the second fall was the DQ. But those guys, they went around the horn and they feuded for a while. And as you said, Carrie, always entertaining. And it was stars going at it at Madison Square Garden. And it was engaging. It was one of those good ones.
And you would get a huge pop from the crowd.
Yes.
Even though the belts are not going to change hands because of the DQ.
Right.
And you use this kind of match to build up for your main event match, which you guys came to see. WWF heavyweight champion Bruno Sammartino pinned Nikolai Volkov in 13 minutes, 9 seconds. Gentlemen, please help me with this one. Last time at the Garden, Nikolai went 53 minutes till 11 p.m. curfew. Now he's only going 13 minutes. Why is that? Is he on his way down already, or they just need the time? Please help me out.
I think it's a time thing. It's still a mystery why they would go 53 minutes the card before. You guys, and we've spoken many times, the last match was always the get to the train, get to your car match, and they wouldn't have the main event, particularly championship match, last. So apparently Bruno studied Nikolai Volkov, and all he needed was 13 minutes.
And the other thing, Carrie, was this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when they had these rematches, the first time they would fight, it would always be longer. And then when they'd have the rematch, for some reason, it was like the revenge match. It was the rematch. And they're going at it, more high spots, faster, in a quicker period of time. And they rarely went like as long as that first match went.
But whatever, every time.
That was their booking philosophy by McMahon.
Every time.
And, you know, this was a short one, but it wasn't the shortest one ever in the history of the Garden. I mean, the shortest title match at Madison Square Garden was only 8 seconds. On November the 26th, 1994, when Diesel, also Kevin Nash, defeated poor Bobby Backlund in those 8 seconds. And Nash's first title defense, January 16th, 1995, he defeated Jeff Jarrett. And the attendance was 5,400. It was not that good.
What was the second shortest match?
Did it happen in 1963 by any chance?
Yes, it did.
47 seconds?
Yes, Bruno and Buddy Rogers.
There you go.
And the shortest match, wasn't that at WrestleMania 1? George Wells got pinned, I think it was by King Kong Bundy, in like 8 seconds or 5 seconds?
Well, WrestleMania 1, that is correct. It was March 31st, 1985, and it was a very short encounter between Bundy with Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart at his side, defeating SD Jones in 9 seconds.
I was there and I don't remember that at all, but thank you for the information. I may have went to take a leak.
You might have went to go to the bathroom with Tony Atlas.
Oh, goodness.
Let's go on. Bruno, we just went over Bruno, 13 minutes. And then I guess that'll be it for Nikolai for a while. Let's go on to match number 6. Gorilla Monsoon pinned one of John's favorites, Don Leo Jonathan, in 14 minutes, 7 seconds.
Yeah, it's Monsoon. But Jonathan, I always hated to see him lose.
I completely agree. Jonathan was just so believable.
Yeah.
And he did have his run with Pedro Morales.
Yes, he did. Two great matches.
And he was older at this time.
Yeah.
I would say that Don Leo Jonathan had been wrestling for 20 years at this point.
Easily, because I have Wrestling Review magazines from 1962 with him on the cover.
Yeah, he was like the real deal. He was very special.
Yeah, agile. And what a flyer at his age. I mean, his height, rather. He was so agile.
Now, Kerry, John and I have talked about this before, and I wanted your opinion about this. We were looking at when Pedro could have lost to Don Leo Jonathan. We thought that would be pretty interesting if Don Leo Jonathan had a run with the belt. What do you think?
It would have been great, but I don't think Don Leo Jonathan wanted to stay in the area. He was still a big deal in Montreal, the Grand Prix territory with the Vachons. And
Andre. He was feuding with Andre everywhere.
Right.
And what a great talent. Now, you can see how the WWF worked in the past. You have a guy like Don Leo Jonathan, works his way up, wrestles Bruno, and now he's working his way back down. He wrestled Gorilla Monsoon. Gorilla Monsoon is getting his height back up because he had lost Nikolai a couple of months ago. So this is a good match for everybody. Everyone's happy. Don Leo Jonathan is working his way out. Gorilla is moving his way up. everyone's happy. Let's go on to the next match. Here's a guy, another guy that is always working his way up or down, depending where his competition is. Now, by this time, match number 7, Jay Strongbow defeated Stan Stasiak because he is on his way down, Stan Stasiak, and Jay needed a little bump up in 7 minutes, 15 seconds.
Yeah, Strongbow, obviously beloved, and Stasiak work, as you said, Tim, working his way down. So it was just a solid match. It was Strongbow with Stasiak, two established stars, Strongbow beloved, Stasiak hated, and it was there, and it was what it was at 7 minutes and 15 seconds.
On April 1st, 1974, was Strongbow still in that ultra-beloved category, or was this was his wheelhouse.
This is his wheelhouse. This was still Strongbow with Strongbow. The fans loved him. They loved his moves. They loved the Indian War Dance. They loved those big knee lifts, the sleeper hold. He was the star. He was a second-tier star right under the main eventers.
And you think back to that, to the War Dance and those aforementioned knee lifts, you would not believe how the crowd would go wild. I mean, it was like an encore for Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
The pop of the crowd, it was just, you know, like a monster. They talk about a monster pop. That was it. And, you know, they talk about, you know, guys that are good workers. And Strongbow gets a lot of criticism, probably because his years as an agent. In the 80s, he shouldn't have been in the ring. But at this time, he had the people by the balls, and he knew how to work them.
He did.
And what makes him and Gorilla Monsoon so interesting to me is they're on this level that, like we were saying, like Gorilla put over Nikolai Volkoff. It was a quick match to give Nikolai that power to go sell out the Garden with Bruno. Okay, so if it wasn't for Gorilla letting him, you know, beat him so quick, maybe he wouldn't have that power. Jay Strongbow, similar guy, where like if someone's coming up the card and they beat Jay Strongbow, oh, that's a pretty big deal to bounce them or give them more bounce to go to the Intercontinental Championship or the WWF Championship. So Stan Stasiak now is on his way down. So how do you get Jay Strongbow back up? You give him a little win. You give it a win.
You give him a win like that. But and you made a good point there. Like, you know, when you would beat a Monsoon or you would beat a Strongbow. And Strongbow, ironically, that's another thing. He really rarely got pinned.
I don't think he had any pins except maybe a tag team match.
Yeah.
They kept him unbeatable they kept him very strong.
And again, it's to help whoever is wrestling him either shoot that person up or when they're coming down, they'll give him another boost. Let's go back to the match. Now we're going to match number 8 where this is really relevant because it's Pedro Morales pinned Larry Henning in 11 minutes, 4 seconds. Now, before Pedro lost the title, he was supposed to wrestle Larry Henning at a main event at Madison Square Garden as a champion, but he lost a title in between there. So he is now at the last match of the card, curtain's closing, John's running to the exit, but there's Pedro and Larry Henning where a few months ago that would have been the prime match. Now it's that we're going downhill match.
Tim, I got to correct you. I might have left before Strongbow Stasiak that night.
Okay. Carrie, did you stay and watch this?
I believe I did. And even though that Larry Henning was really at the tail end of his career, he was another guy for me. And I want John's opinion, even though he had to go get the train.
I might have wanted to get a slice first, too, before the train. So maybe I left a little early.
Henning was still a guy that I felt was a believable wrestler. And, you know, he was a tough man. So despite that he was at the end of his career, you knew, I don't know, there was an air of, a slight air of danger with him.
Yeah, always with Henning. He was rough. I mean, this was his last show at the Garden. He was 0-5 at the Garden. I mean, he lost to Morales due to blood, November 12, 73. He loses December 10th in that rematch to Morales. He teams with Mike McCord. They lose to Ho and Gurria, January 14, 74. And he loses to Ho and Gurria again, this time teaming with Stasiak. And now on April 1st, loses to Morales. So even though as tough as he was, and the wins that he did get, TV or otherwise, he didn't win at the Garden. It's crazy.
Wow. And he is one of those guys that we I never knew coming in. This is the back in the day, and this is what makes it so interesting to me, that you pull guys in from different territories. So he's coming from the AWA territory, just like when you see Vern Gagne come in. Here's Larry the Axe Henning coming in, does a couple of shows, maybe, you know, does a couple of things, makes a couple of bucks, and takes off. But he is still a big name because, and Kerry, we always talk about this, the magazines. You learn about these guys from the magazines back then. So you saw, you knew who this guy was. He didn't need so many months of pushing on TV because you've been reading about him all that time. Is that true, Kerry?
For me, it was true. I read years before this about Race and Henning, Harley Race and Larry Henning back in the old AWA. And
champions.
Henning, you know, the AWA got good press in the magazines, and Henning, he was a big guy. You know, I think he was like a legit, like 6'4", 280-pound guy.
I remember every magazine, like the Wrestling World magazine from that era. I mean, you'd see their pictures, and it was Henning and Race, always on top of that tag team ratings for the AWA.
Absolutely.
And I still love those ratings in those magazines. That would be one of the first things I would read in every one of the magazines. Where are the ratings? Let me see where these guys are. And then seeing them live, it was always a treat.
Absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, John, Kerry, what do you think of the card? Kerry, we'll start with you.
Good card. I had become numb, and I had a sense of acceptance to these not-so-great early matches and even some of these middle-of-the-card matches that were not so great, but we accepted it. And my cousin Mike, who I mentioned earlier, who went to almost all these shows with, every time the show started, it was like, this is great. The opening bout. That opening bout had that special air about it. But yeah, this was a good show. I mean, we got to see Bruno with a nice win. It had some star power with Henning, and Don Leo Jonathan was special. I don't think Tommy Cerruto meant that much to me at that time, honestly. But yeah, good card.
I would say the same.
Good card. We're looking back at a time in wrestling where, like you were just saying, if you look back at it and you go watch the whole matches again, maybe you wouldn't think the same. But what made the Garden so special was the atmosphere. And like you were talking about earlier, Kerry, it's like the buildup and the whistling and the patting of the feet. And then all of a sudden the lights go out, like they had something to do with it. They sped it up. You know, you were part of this. Nowadays, you know, everyone knows that they'll give you the signal when everything's going to happen. Back then, they didn't give you the signal. And Kerry, we talked earlier about this. There was no music. There was no anything. So it would go in like a wave. So if you had seats directly across from the locker rooms, you can start to see, you see the curtain open up, and then you see the little light, and you see something. Something's coming out, and you get excited. And as you get excited, then it goes around the arena. It doesn't happen like that anymore. Now everyone sees it at the same time.
No, nowadays, and for the last 20 years or more than that, apparently, the wrestlers are friends with the sound and production people, that they know their music, you know, and it was that way in Ring of Honor, too. You know, look, we're talking 50 years ago. This is what we knew, and this is what we accepted. And one last thing, I'm looking at next month's card. As a preview, it's Bruno and Kowalski. One of the biggest things, and I know this has been spoken about before, was when the ring announcer, whether it was Johnny Addy or it was Friendly Bob Fried, and eventually Howard Finkel, would say, ladies and gentlemen, point at the bell. They'd give the bell a few rings. On April 29th, on a Monday night, here's the next, and Willie Gilsenberg shuffled out with the little piece of paper. And that was like one of the most exciting things of the night, hearing what the next card would be. I'm referencing this particularly because Kowalski has not been on these shows, the last few shows. He definitely was on TV. So it's like, that is a big deal, Bruno and Killer Kowalski.
Absolutely. And because of their feuds from the past, Kowalski's back in the territories with the Grand Wizard of Wrestling. This match was something that drew big interest for Bruno against Kowalski after all this time, them facing each other. This was a TV situation. It wasn't on live TV, but it was a sellout closed circuit deal. And I remember it specifically because of that show. And we'll get into it in the next episode because there's a lot on there. This match is on YouTube, and I'm in that first row, and I'm on camera almost the whole match, taking pictures in that front row, sitting next to my cousin Anthony, Frank Favalli, Sal DiPietro. It was the two-pay match, which we'll talk about. And it was also the first time that it was an actual close-up. And you watch it, there's a close-up of the blade in Bruno's hand, and he's adjusting it before he's cutting himself. And it's crazy. And the other thing that was spectacular about it was the opportunity in a tag team match to see Andre the Giant face off against Don Leo Jonathan. And some of my favorite photos I ever took in my career were from this night with Andre staring down Don Leo in the middle of the ring. Never forget it.
All right, we are looking forward to that. That's going to be April 29th, 1974. And once again, we want to thank, you know, the people that put this together for us, the people that help us the most, besides Richie, besides Kerry, it is Scott Teal and his friends over at Crowbar Press.
Amazing book, Bible. The Bible. The Bible. It's totally the Bible. Go to Crowbar Press. Pick it up. Wrestling in the Garden. Wow, which one is that, Kerry, you're holding up?
An older copy.
No kidding.
Yes.
That was like the original copy of it, the original first edition, before it got all fancy with a color cover.
Yeah, I have that one buried away too. But yeah, I keep this handy.
Isn't that amazing that we're holding these books and just like we open it up and we look at these and the memories just start flooding back?
I'll read them over and over and over. Yes, but too. I could, and I don't look at the Ring of Honor matches, and we had some really good shows. It's strange how most people gravitate to their earliest loves.
Yes.
You know? So I look forward, and thank you guys. I look forward to our next show.
All right. Anything else, John?
No, I just want to thank Richie Garcia, as always, for doing that great research in each and every episode. Thanking you, Tim, Kerry. This is going to be so much fun bringing you aboard on these shows from here on in. We're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to have a lot of laughs. We're going to have a lot of memories. And who knows what's going to pop into our heads as we go month to month. And then we remember these little nuances of that night and little things that happen. So it's going to be cool. I'm looking forward to it.
For John Arizzi, Kerry Silkin, Richie Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time.